Thank you for inviting me to give this talk. It was not meant to be given, but when discussing with Sergei, this thing resurfaced, and I said, well, I have to talk about it. So I'm a particle physicist, and so I should maybe, at a certain point, I will tell you how I ended up doing this. So this thing started essentially like a hobby, and like most hobbies, it became an obsession with years, and I think it's about time that it becomes a profession, and I hope it will, and I can explain what these three things are. But before that, let me just tell you. So this started a long time ago with papers that were not dealing with this, and so there was a then the puzzle or the obsession started here with this paper with Endlich, Nicolis, and Wang, and it developed in an unpublished and failed project with Solomon Endlich, Walter Goldberger, and Ira Rothstein. And so then with some effort during the pandemic, it ended up in a paper, which is with Darcy and Khmelnitsky, who is out on the web. And this is where the obsession perhaps ended. And I hope that in the work I'm doing here, this is becoming more serious, more professional, okay? So how I ended up with this? To give you a slight motivation. Oh, I mean, that's not the motivation, how it started. Then this is not the motivation, how it started. So you can ask the question, what is cosmology? Well, cosmology is this, right? This is the dynamics of cosmology, and it involves left and right two things. On the left, you have gravity, the dynamics of space-time, and on the right, you have stuff. And stuff that fills space. Well, essentially, you have, from the point of view of energy physicists, you have condensed matter. You, rather than having the vacuum with which you do normally experiments in particle physics to assess, you do the most stupid experiments to study the Hamiltonian, the Lagrangian. Here, instead, we have state with high occupation. The state is roughly, at least, early enough universe. Homogeneous and isotropic, so the Andrewton tensor can write it roughly as two pieces. One is the background, and the background describes what? The finite density quantum field theory, so which is to say a state of quantum field theory with a preferential frame, finite density state. So it's a state, you can say technically, where the Poincaré symmetry of the underlying quantum field theory, we're going to short distances, okay? Not at the size of the curvature, when the local dynamics is, in a sense, spontaneously broken down to the groups of translation, rotations, and in fact also time translations, because the system without gravity would be stationary. And on top of that, so you have a symmetry breaking, call it spontaneous symmetry breaking, and on top of that you have fluctuations, and when you have symmetry breaking, the fluctuations, the necessary fluctuation, you can have more, but the fluctuations you have necessarily are the Goldstone modes or soft modes, okay? Which, in the case of a finite system, are the hydrodynamic modes. So sound waves are just a particular incarnation of these Goldstones. Now, Goldstone, normally you would have to use the name Goldstone only when you are quantum mechanical, okay? And the Goldstone is an individual quantum associated with these modes. Classically, these we call them soft modes. Modes whose frequency goes down to zero, okay, as the wavelength goes to infinity. Okay. Now, this is the situation in cosmology. This normally, in ordinary cosmology, late-time cosmology, this is a classical situation. But in the early universe, this can be quantum mechanical. Okay, think of inflation, and this raises a general question. Which options, in general, just if you want to explore what is possible according to the principles of local quantum field theory, which options for the dynamics behind T mu nu are even possible? And technically, you can frame this as the question, what is the space of sensible effective field theory that realize the spontaneous breaking of the Poincaré group down to the group of a homogeneous isotropic stationary system? Okay? I always forget to write also time translations. Okay? So that's how we started. And you can start classifying. And we did classify some of these things. But let me give you, now, when you start this game, this game was motivated, say, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, by the interest in understanding how can you modify gravity at cosmological distances, how is that related to to the acceleration measured by astrophysicists. And so then we started classifying things, okay? And when we started classifying things, we immediately stumbled onto the realization that one of the simplest things that you would expect to understand, at least it's not understandable so easily. In fact, it is puzzling. Let me explain. So let me give you the examples of what I want to talk about. So even the statement here requires some specification. So let me give you the simplest example of such a system that gives you a finite density situation. The simplest thing you can think of is the relativistic superfluid. So what is the relativistic superfluid? Relativistic superfluid is a situation where you have a scalar field, okay, that is, in a sense, the Goldstone boson of some internal U1 symmetry. The scalar symmetry endowed with the shift symmetry. In concrete situation, this could be the phase mode of some ordinary complex scalar. But at the very heart, all you need is this, okay? And a superfluid is a situation where a quantum field theory with this scalar with the symmetry is in a state where the scalar has an expectation value, or it has a background that is linear in time. Remember, this is always a solution because the equations of motion for phi are second order, so there's always a solution linear in the coordinate. In particular, there's a solution linear in time. So this is the solution, this is the fluctuation. So a situation like this is a situation where this phi is a clock. Okay? Rather than asking what time is it, you can ask what is the value of phi. Okay? This is what we call a cosmic clock. Okay? So there's a correlation between the value of phi and t. Okay? And the fluctuations of this object, so this is a state that has a preferential frame, okay, the frame where the expectation value is purely a long time. And so that boosts are broken. In fact, the Poincaré and the U1 symmetry is also broken. Well, it was broken to start with. And if you look at it carefully, you realize that Poincaré times the U1 is broken to the group, the Euclidean group in three dimensions, times an effective time translation. And the effective time translation is a linear combination of the original time translation that acts only on coordinates and the shifts of phi. You see, if I shift time, it's equivalent to shifting phi, so I can compensate for. So this configuration is not invariant at the shift of time, but if you combine that with the shift of phi by internal symmetry, that's the symmetry. And the effective Hamiltonian is nothing but H minus mu q, which is the effective Hamiltonian time translation generator of a superfluid. Okay? And as a matter of fact, now if you write the most general Lagrangian, ordered by ordinary derivative expansion along it to the charisma of modern effective field theory, you find that you can describe any superfluid you want. In fact, particularly if you work at the lowest derivative level, okay, the only object you can write down, the only invariant under the symmetry in Poincaré is this. So then the Lagrangian is just a function of this object. And the function of the Lagrangian just gives you the equation of state. Okay? Equation of state is one-to-one correspondence with the Lagrangian, okay? Because if you compute energy Newton tensor, you see rho and p are just associated with this function. And okay, that's at the level of just the expectation value. But that very same function, when you expand in terms of the fluctuations around the solution, will give you all the scattering amplitude for an arbitrary number of modes, pi, which are just the phonons in the superfluid. So in other words, you have what we call soft phonon scattering theorems that predict all the scattering amplitude at leading order for phonons just in terms of the equation of state. This is, for instance, was understood in many cases even before, but it was nicely elucidated by Sun. Going towards what is, so what can you have beyond this? So as I said, here I have a scalar that works like a clock. You can also imagine to have a scalar or a bunch of scalars that work like rulers. So imagine I have three scalars, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. Again, endowed with the same shift symmetry. Phi 1 shifts independently from phi 2. Okay, you have three shift symmetry. In a sense, I already have a U1 cube. And imagine that these three scalars have expectation values that are proportional to coordinates in this and that and the other direction. Okay, in such a way, and then there are fluctuations around them. But if you forget the fluctuation, now, rather than asking what time is it as what is the value of phi, now you ask where you are, and asking where you are is like asking where what is the value of phi. Okay, so now these are, you've traded the coordinates with the value of the field. Okay, what system is this? Okay, well, this system without any additional symmetry is an anisotropic solid. If you start adding additional internal rotational or discrete symmetry, you can produce solids with any, I mean, cubic, whatever, okay, all the side, with all the discrete symmetries that you can think of. You can even imagine having a full SO3 symmetry among these three guys, which implies that the solid is a fully homogeneous solid, like a jelly. And you can go, and these are all solids, okay? And the excitations here are going to be nothing but the phonons in the solid. You can take it as a quantum field theory at zero temperature. And with this thing, again, very much before with the superfluid, you can describe any solid, including relativistic effects. Okay, even the retardation effects having to do with relativity in the solid. But you can go further and endow this internal field space with a much bigger symmetry, which is volume-preserving diffs. Okay? In other words, all volume-preserving reparametrization of the internal target space, phi, okay? The internal phi space. This is just a statement that this is volume-preserving. Now, what do you have in this case? What you have in this case is a relativistic fluid. In fact, you can write in this way the most general relativistic fluid, very much before you were writing the most general relativistic superfluid. How you construct it? Well, you construct this sort of meson field. And then to comply with this symmetry at the leading order in the derivative expansion, you have the de Lagrangian. This again is only the function of one thing, which is the determinant of this object. Notice that this object around the background is non-zero. Okay, and again, you derive the equations of motion, the energy momentum tensor. And again, you find that this F is simply giving you the equation of state of a relativistic perfect fluid. Okay. And if you may ask, but what is the role of this huge symmetry you have? Well, this huge symmetry is there. I mean, what does this huge symmetry imply as a consequence of the Noether theorem? Well, the consequence of this symmetry is nothing but Kelvin's theorem, which is this theorem that establishes that, well, to say it roughly, that vorticity is conserved along the flow. Okay. Right? If you compute, at least in a non-relativistic case, that's easy. This gives you the relativistic generalization, if you want, of Kelvin's theorem, okay, including relativistic effects. And if you take the chapter where Weinberg, in this gravity book of 1973, does relativistic fluids, this is just a Lagrangian that reproduces that dynamics.
Sorry, is it a nonlinear sigma model, the Lagrangian?
In what sense? These are all sigma models, in the sense that sigma models a sigma model is a system that realizes the spontaneous breaking of a symmetry G down to a symmetry H. Okay, so this is a sigma model that realizes spontaneous breaking of Poincaré times volume-preserving diffs down to iso3. Okay. So, but it's a sigma model where the symmetry G is a space-time symmetry. It's not an internal symmetry. Yes, in that sense, it's a sigma model. Now, without much ado, let me tell you. So you would, by the way, this description has been derived many, many times. I'm quoting Carter here, but I think also Gibbs had something like that. And in the first paper I quoted, we derived it without knowing that others, and many other, I think other, it's a recurrent thing. In fact, the first paper by Lagrange on Lagrangians, I think it was about fluids. It's the Accademia, Rendiconti dell'Accademia Reale di Torino. I have never found it. I'd be very happy to find it, to see whether I should even go back forward to. Okay, so what's the deal about this thing? Let me get quickly to the deal. And again, as a particle physicist, effective field theorist, what we do, we take Lagrangians, then we expand them around their solution, then we start taking quadratic, cubic, then we quantize, construct a Fock space, consider scattering, do a little experiment, beef, beef, look at the angles, okay? That's particle physics, okay? So you can do it with all the systematic cast so far, with the superfluid, for the solid. By the way, these techniques are also interesting. So if you want to study systematically how to couple a dark sector to a superfluid helium, in order to think which experiments you can build, take this Lagrangian, couple to dark matter, and then drive systematically on the interaction. If you want to couple dark matter to a solid, take this Lagrangian with the other thing. If you slightly break this shift symmetry, phi is still a clock, what do you get? It's not really linear in time, it moves. You get inflation, okay? So inflation is a slightly deformed relativistic superfluid coupled to gravity, okay? So this language is actually, I mean, it's not just aesthetics. There's also some practical aspects to it. But let me come to the deal, okay? So for this relativistic, so normally we are used that, again, as particle theorists, you have a Lagrangian, you can view it either classically, it's a classical system, or you can say, oh, now I want to really see this as a quantum mechanical system. I construct a path integral. I hope I have a weakly coupled window where I can describe in terms of weakly coupled quanta. Normally, in theories where you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, the soft modes, the Goldstones, are only coupled through derivative. So at long enough wavelength, they are always weakly coupled. So this is always going to work. Okay. However, in this case, something funny happens, which in a sense should have been expected if we were sufficiently knowledgeable about fluid mechanics when we started this, which we were. Okay, so let me tell you what happened. Okay, so what happens is that when you expand, and by the way, let's say I am a totally, I don't know that fluids exist. Okay, I'm just trying to explore what systems can propel the evolution of the universe. So I'm just formulating. I know the principles of local quantum field theory, and I know gravity, and I know the equation Friedman, okay? And I want to find, classify the sources of T mu nu in terms of field theory, okay? And as I said, I can find the superfluid, and then the next thing, I find this. Let me tell you why we did this, because at the time when people were thinking about massive gravity, stuff like that, we were dealing with systems that were a lot more crazy than this, okay? And had all sorts of pathologies, okay? And so then we reanalyzed, we went back and reanalyzed the systems we know. Superfluid worked very well. It's like the theory of inflation. But when you get to the fluid, you find the following, okay? So expand around the stationary configuration, okay? The equilibrium configuration. What you find, okay, now around this configuration, you have a marriage between the internal symmetry, the volume preserving diffs, and space-time, and there is a residual rotational invariance, which is a mixture of the two. So now this internal degree of freedom, which would transform purely under the internal symmetry, now also transforms under rotation, okay? So this object, you should really treat it as a vector, okay, as an ordinary vector, okay? And now you write its quadratic Lagrangian, and you find it has this form, okay? Oh, very nice, pi dot, okay? And the gradient part, however, it's proportional to the divergence, because it's a divergence square of pi. So it only involves the longitudinal Remember, a vector in three dimensions contains a longitudinal component and two transverse components. The gradient part of the Lagrangian only affects the longitudinal. Okay? And the coefficient, okay, is nothing but the speed of sound. For the transverse component, you have zero. So for the transverse component, you have that for whatever wavelength, for whatever momentum of the would-be quanta, the frequency is zero. Okay? So you have a situation where if you take fluctuations that go to arbitrary short distance in wavelength, they still have zero energy, at least naively. Okay? It's one of those situations where it looks like the UV and the IR are not really separated, because the IR is low energies, okay, long wavelength. And here you have a situation where a small wavelength, which is short distance, you have no gap. Okay? And technically, you can say this with the fact that now you see this transverse mode has a Lagrangian which has only dotted pi dot. So if you go to the Fourier space, okay, each Fourier mode has a quadratic Lagrangian which is similar to the Lagrangian of a free particle on a line, or a free particle in whatever space. Okay, it's not a harmonic oscillator. Quantum mechanically, in a situation like this, the lowest energy state is spread all over the place, right? In the harmonic oscillator, the ground state is localized at the minimum of the potential. There is e to the minus, there's an exponential localization. For a free particle on the line, well, first of all, there's no ground state. And as you make the energy smaller and smaller, you spread all over the place. Okay? So this is just to tell you that if this system makes any sense, the transverse phonons are not described by a Fock space. So what I've been doing all my life as a particle theorist, construct the Fock space, do a little scattering, this cannot be done. Okay? So this is an interesting, different than when I'm used to field theory, so this is where the obsession started. What is this? Okay? So in other words, the vacuum here is not localized in field space. And you cannot treat this system, even if it is derivatively coupled like any Goldstone boson, you cannot treat it in perturbation theory. This is unavoidably non-perturbative. Of course, you may even ask, does this system make sense? Maybe it could be that this system doesn't make any sense quantum mechanically. After all, at zero temperature, it seems like there are no fluids. Okay? So meaning, if I want to interpret this quantum mechanically, it would be interpreting this system at zero temperature. And we don't know of any system like that. But maybe it's because they exist, but we cannot interpret them in the proper way because we have never really made the construction of a quantum mechanical perfect fluid.
Short distance physics may introduce some sort of energy.
Yeah, that's the question now to compute. Yeah. I'll get to that in a moment. Let me just tell you classically why this result is not surprising. This is the basis of turbulence. Turbulence is the term that if there is a boat that is 1 kilometer long and gets into your bay, it starts making eddies when it moves. These eddies then interact, then they go slowly, and they make smaller eddies that also go slowly because there's no gap, okay? And you make smaller and smaller and smaller eddy until the point where a big boat creates a situation where the eddies are so small that they get to the point where they dissipate in microscopic motion, heat. Okay? So in a sense, a big thing became something small. Okay? So that's...
Sorry, can you say again the temperature equals zero comment you made before?
I'm doing field theory. So this is I'm writing Lagrangian field theory. Okay? So I'm not doing a statistical distribution. This is just...
So from the fluid perspective, you would be...
For the fluid perspective, there's another set of questions that is the professional part that I will get to the end, which is, okay, you will see where I go here. And then the question is, the real fluids, those that exist, for instance, in hot QCD, let's say a very simple relativistic fluid like hot Young Mills, how do you describe it? What is it? Technically, what type of effective field theory is it? It is effective field theory where There are dissipative effects, there are statistical effects, there are quantum effects. How do you systematically describe this system? I think this is a question, in my opinion, this is not dealt with yet.
So this transfer exponent is just to make...
This transfer exponent is the first approximation of a vortex. Okay.
It's, but you have some plasma, right?
That's there is a fluid, there is stuff. There is a fluid at rest, okay. And then you make a...
Okay.
Is it clear?
Yes, it's clear. Thank you.
Just to comment about discretization, because is it because of relativistic? I'm thinking of Landau.
No. It's not. We will get to Landau. We will get to Landau. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
so we will get Landau is the next page. Okay. Landau, 1941.
Yeah.
Of course, we'll get to the next page. The 1941 is also the date in the movie by Spielberg, okay, with what's his name, John Belushi. Okay. The problem has to do with the transverse modes. So let's zoom on the problem. Zoom on the problem. You go to the incompressible limit. Namely, you study motions that are slow enough, much slower than the speed of sound, and when you move slowly, you don't make sound, okay? So you can decouple sound. Or if you want technical, you can just say that you eliminate one of the 3 degrees of freedom. In other words, that you fix the constraint that the mapping between phi and x space is as determinant one. Anyway, technically you can do it this way. But physically, this can always be encompassed. Any fluid in the regime of very slow motions behave like as incompressible. Okay, and the only modes that remain in that case are precisely these transverse, the soft modes, these guys that are very soft. So you can describe your fluid in this limit, as I say schematically here, as the mapping between the space of x and the space of phi. Now, in the case I discussed in the beginning, the space of x is R3 and phi is R3, but very soon we will work in a compact space. You can think of this as torus, sphere, and this is going to be also the same thing. Okay, so and the mapping between now the system we are describing here, the degrees of freedom are nothing but the mapping between an internal space that has exactly the same structure, it's isomorphic to our physical space, and this mapping is volume preserved. Okay, and the fluid velocity, okay, if you want in A, I always make confusion. Lagrangian, damn it. There's the Eulerian Lagrangian. The Lagrangian way is nothing but, you see, every phi. See, now you can really go back and forward. As I said, phi tells you where you are. So you can go from phi to x and vice versa. So very much as before, I was saying phi is a function of x. That's my field. But I can also go backward and say x as a function of phi. And x as a function of phi means that there is some piece of this stuff, and I follow it. OK, phi is constant, and I see how it moves with time, okay, and the variation as time passes of x of phi with phi fixed is nothing but the fluid velocity. Now this limit is unavoidably non-relativistic because the speed of sound in any sensible fluid is less than the speed of light, and if you have to be much slower than the speed of sound, you are for sure non-relativistic, and in this limit, the Lagrangian boils down to simply a constant density times a velocity squared. Notice that this velocity is a non-trivial object because it's the time derivative of a constrained field. Okay, so there is physics. I mean, it's not just V dot square.
Fluid elements might cross each other.
Yeah, let's forget about that. This doesn't cross my mind. Yeah, sure, it can happen that you break, that you end up in a regime where your effective field breaks down. Could be. Yeah. If you have a very, I could imagine this happening in a very dramatic situation. I want to do quantum mechanics where I have the smallest quanta of fluctuations of the fluid, where this cannot happen. Maybe it will happen, but I want to assume that. You see, in any field theory, if I go to sufficiently big field, something crazy can happen. And I'm willing to assume that we are not yet there. But yeah. Okay? Yeah. So So now you're down to this object here, okay? And V is a constraint variable. And now you would like to derive the Hamiltonian and see what you can say about the energy levels, okay? To do it properly, if you do it canonically, you can use the constraint Hamiltonian construction or corresponding quantization of Dirac. In fact, you can avoid doing that, okay? You can do it in a less technical way. Never mind. Just very quickly, n bidimensional analysis, where do you expect to end up? Look, you have rho v square. You will derive some canonical momentum by taking the derivative of this with respect to the dotted variable, and the momentum, the conjugated momentum will be rho times some derivative. So when you then pull back modulo constraints and you write your Hamiltonian, rho, which plays the role like of the mass for a particle, will end up in the denominator. Is this clear? This is just when you have mx dot square, you get one. So once you have this here, then the question is quantum mechanically. So you have a Hamiltonian which has a rho in the denominator, just quantum mechanically. What do you expect the energy levels be of that? Okay. So the energy is E, okay, and here you will have some variables. What can you expect from it? It could be that by the way, this is an effective theory, okay? Any system in physics is an effective theory. Things that I can study, okay, is an effective theory, okay, and by the fluid you can understand there's a genuine, you expect genuine, there is a length or a scale which for an ordinary fluid is the mean free path below which you cannot talk about these degrees of freedom. It looks very different, okay. So the question is what scale will appear there, okay. And now you can do a little dimensional analysis, okay? This is rho, it's mass density, okay? And you have to form an energy, okay? If UV physics, who was asking about UV physics at a certain point coming in? Was it you? No, somebody else. Eh? Maxime, okay, Maxime, sorry, Maxime, yeah. So Maxime was asking, if UV physics comes in as dramatically as it can, you expect something like this in n dimension, okay? That's actually what Landau cleverly argued in his 1941 paper, where he derived famous description of superfluids. Okay? Landau actually started not with the superfluid Lagrange that I described at the beginning, of course, at the time. It started with an ordinary fluid. And he had, remember, in a superfluid, there's only one degree of freedom. There's only one phonon. Okay? There's only one. There are not 3 degrees of freedom. So he started with this. And when he got to these shear variables, he said, they don't commute. Things that don't commute get gapped. It will get the gap. It's heavy. It's gone. The only thing that is left is the compressional mode, which is precisely what Kapitsa was seeing. Okay? So in a sense, I think, so this is what Landau claimed. Okay? This is a bit weird, though, because if you think that if this symmetry that I was talking about makes sense, you would expect that quantum mechanically, there will still be a no gap, okay? Like the Goldstone theorem, okay? So there is the option, there's the other option, which some of us speculated in 2010, that the scale here is purely infrared, okay? It's like a sort of Casimir energy, okay? And again, just by dimensional analysis, you would deduce it goes like k to the 2 plus n, which means that, say, in 3 space dimension, it will go like k to the 5th, very soft. You are so good. Can you get this guy out of the? Yes. Now it turns out that both things are wrong. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. And you could have. But then how you come up? Yeah. And the rest of the talk is essentially how to get to that.
Okay.
So this is the situation. Any question? Let me see how much am I doing with time. So now, this is essentially the situation. But how do you compute this? How do you go about this? And here enters another Russian, okay, Arnold, okay, as we were discussing before. Now, let me get to the simplest possible situation in order to be hopefully quantitative, okay? So as I said, so far I was talking generally of an first compressible, then incompressible, in any dimension. Let me go to the simplest situation where I have a fluid with transverse modes. Okay, transverse modes, okay, they appear first in dimension two. Okay, in dimension one, you only have compression. So let's go to two dimension. And to make things manageable, let's work in a compact space. Let's take the simplest possible compact space, a torus. Okay? So in other words, our space, okay, is just a square with identified boundaries. Okay? And the mapping is that. Okay? And now, in the incompressible limit, the dynamical variables can be viewed as the volume-preserving mapping of x into phi, but x and phi are the same space. So the dynamical variables are nothing but the elements of the volume-preserving, area-preserving diff group on the torus. Okay. So we are in a situation where we have a dynamical, mechanical system that behaves, whose dynamical variable is just a point moving on a group manifold. Now, the group manifold is infinite dimensional, but it's still a group manifold, okay? Motion of a group manifold. This makes our system, as pointed out here, I believe, I don't know whether it was the first time or not, but at least this is where I learned it, just a member of the family of generalized rigid bodies. Okay? So what is a rigid body? Is generalized rigid body is nothing but a point mechanical particle moving on a manifold that is a group manifold. Okay? The simplest known example is the rigid body, the real rigid body, this object here, where the group is SO3. And how do you see that? So a rigid body is like a potato, okay, like this. To describe its configuration, what you do, you take three toothpicks and you serve them as you please. You can do it as you wish, but if you do them orthogonally, I think it's nice, okay? And you can choose them as you wish, okay? And depending on how you choose them, the moment of inertia will have a different form, okay? Because if this is a potato, if it's a sphere, it's a sphere. But I'm interested in a potato, okay? And then the configuration of your system, the orientation of your system is simply given by the O3 matrix that maps, that brings the potato axis aligned with the axis of your lab. Okay? So given the axis of your lab, you ask, what is the configuration of the potato? And I give you an O3 matrix, which is the matrix that brings those axes aligned with the axis of the potato. Okay? So the configuration of the potato is an O3 matrix. Okay? And the angular velocities are nothing but the derivative of this matrix times the matrix inverse. Okay? It's called the Cartan form. Okay? And so on. Okay? And you see, it's just qualitatively the same idea, okay? The only difference is that this is a group of dimension three, okay? It has three generators, here it has infinitely many. Slightly more on the technical side. In the case of the rigid body, okay, as I said, the configuration is given by an O3 matrix, and you can think of two different actions, O3 actions, on this configuration matrix itself. You can rotate, you can change experimentalists. You can take your experimentalist and rotate the experimentalist, okay? That's a symmetry, that's rotations, okay? And this normally is called the left action, okay? That's a symmetry, okay? That's ordinary rotations. But you can also rotate to the right. And this corresponds to rotating your toothpicks with respect to the potato, okay? By choosing a different frame in the potato. This is not a symmetry if you are dealing with a potato, okay? So there is the left and the right action. You have exactly the same situation in the fluid. Mathematicians normally invert left and right. Since I'm not a mathematician, I use a different thing where the left is the symmetry. For Arnold goes on and say, oh, for the fluid, it is the right symmetry. It is a symmetry in the left. But come on, we exchange the right and left. They're all, you look yourself in the mirror and everything is fine, okay? The action, the volume-preserving diff, okay, this is a function mapping of phi to x. The action of the group, it can either be on the coordinate phi or the coordinate x. The action on the coordinate x is not a symmetry because the only symmetry space-time is translation and rotation boosts. Okay, but now we are really non-relativistic. Okay, and Galilean is gone because we are on a torus. Okay, but anyway, and this is symmetry. So again, we have a doubling of the group action left and right. Okay, in the very same way. Okay. And when you go to the Hamiltonian construction, the parallel continues, okay? Let me just, here on the left, I show you the story for the rigid body. The good variables with which to write the Hamiltonian, and this you learned in the course of mechanics, are the angular momenta projected on the body, okay? If you see the Hamiltonian, these angular momenta projected on the body up to a sign are precisely the generator of the right group. Of the broken symmetry. And the Hamiltonian is written in terms of the generator of the right action, is written this way, okay? Normally, they are not indicated by R, they are indicated by L body, say, again, in Arnold, but I call them R generators, okay? And you see that these are not symmetries because for a generic moment of inertia, the Hamiltonian is not invariant under rotations. But these are the rotations, these I and J are rotation index with respect to the body, okay? Not with respect to the lab. Then what do you do? Okay, then the quantized system, or even if you consider the algebra associated with these variables, either classically or quantum mechanically. Classically, you can compute the Poisson brackets, and they generate the group action, of course. Okay, and quantum mechanically, they satisfy the ordinary angular momentum algebra, even though these are not conserved, okay? Now, what about now the Hilbert space and the energy levels? Well, again, this it's a textbook thing. Turns out the following, it works like this. So what is the Hilbert space of the complete set of, what is the basis of orthonormal functions on a group manifold, okay? What is the basis on any group manifold? What is the basis? What is the complete basis of functions of the group manifold? What this basis is dictated by Peter Weyl's theorem. Okay, Peter Weyl's theorem tells you that the basis of this function is given in the following way. You take all possible representations of the group. So in the case of SO3, you get the singlet, you get the spin 1/2, spin 1, spin 3/2, and so on and so forth. For each representation, you have a 2L plus 1 times 2L plus 1 matrix. Okay? Take all the entries of these matrices, their function of the three Lie parameters, the three Euler angles. Okay? It turns out the complete set of these entries for all the set of representation is the basis of your of function on the group manifold. Okay? And this Hilbert space, therefore, can be written as a direct sum of spaces for each of these, for each representation. You have 2L plus 1, 2L plus 1. So you have 2L plus 1 square states, okay? And which you can view as representing L, L of SO3 left, SO3 right. In other words, each representation, you can act to the left or to the right, okay? And therefore, it's something like this. And the left action is, again, rotating the experimentalist, and the right action is rotating the toothpicks with respect to the body, okay? And now you compute, now computing the energy levels, it's easy, okay? Just for every subspace, you simply have to replace here the representations of angular momenta in that particular representation, you compute all the energy level, and Peter Weyl's theorem tells you the multiplicity, okay? It tells you that each object comes with the 12 plus 1 multiplicity, not degeneracy, okay? Each angular momentum is 12 plus 1 degenerate, because again, it's the 12 plus 1 orientation of the whole body, or if you want, it's equivalent to rotating the experimentalist, okay? You rotate the experimentalist, the state of motion doesn't change, okay? The other multiplicity has to do with realizing a given angular momentum in a way, it corresponds to rotating the angular momentum with respect to the body. Okay? The total angular momentum is the same, but the form of the motion is different. Right? You can have the same angular momentum rotating this way, but you can also have it where it does the other thing. Okay? So this is why you have a double. Okay? Now, in the case of the rigid body, you have a complete parallel. The analog of this right of the charges of the angular momentum projected on the body is the vorticity. I have I have 15 minutes, right? Okay. I think I have to speed up. Okay, it's the vorticity. And the Hamiltonian is simply as simple as this form, where you see the vorticity, if you interpret the vorticity as a charge density, this looks like an this is precisely the electrostatic Hamiltonian in two dimensions. R is not conserved, but is conserved convectively, okay, along the flow. And if you're on the torus, the algebra, the analog of the algebra of SO3, which is the algebra of volume preserving diffs on the torus, you can write it better in Fourier space, where N and M, these are just the discrete momenta on the torus. I mean, when you do the Fourier transform of this object, you have this algebra. So this is the well-known algebra of volume preserving diffs on the torus.
What are the left charges?
The left charges are acting on the phis. Okay, they're like redefining they're just realizing the same. They're like realizing the same situation with the same velocity, but remixing the phis. It's equivalent in the body of having the same state of motion of the body, but it, simply your body is oriented in a different way in space. It has the same.
Right. And they commute with ours, right?
Oh, yeah, they commute with ours, yeah.
Yeah, just continue because you don't have phi anymore, right? I mean, they already
That's one of the questions that is not totally solved, yes. I'll get to that in a moment. Yes. Then the question is that there are two questions here, one technical and one conceptual. The technical question is how to deal, to do the same Peter Weyl thing for this infinite group, okay? Which may be done somewhere, but I actually did it in an artisanal way myself, but then I'll get to that in a moment. And the other has to do with this, the interpretation of this additional degeneracy, okay? Because once you fix this, you fix the velocity, okay? But then you still have it's essentially every state of motion of the fluid has twice as much entropy as you would think. Because the Hilbert space is not dimension n, it's dimension n squared in some units. So the entropy is a factor of 2 bigger. So yeah, this additional degeneracy is, to me, hard to interpret. And maybe I should have stopped at this stage. But let me tell you what you can do, okay? I see two options for that. The first option is, say, I gauge S diffs. S diff is gauged, okay? But if I gauge the symmetry, it means that I have to project only on the states that are invariant under the left. But because of this structure here, because of the correlation between the left and the right quantum number, if I project the only left invariant state is also R invariant, and it's just a trivial state, okay? And so if I gauge this symmetry, I project away all the variables because I only go directly to the ground state of the shear modes. And what I am back with, if I had it in the beginning, is only the compression mode, which is a superfluid. Now, this is what Feynman would have said is the right way Landau would have had to argue. Because in the case of Landau, somehow these particles are not distinguishable. So the indistinguishability of the bosons in this description. This is not the way Feynman says it, okay? This is my interpretation. Then the indistinguishability of the bosons just should correspond to the fact that the symmetry should be gauged. And then that would be the end of it, okay? And this is, and Feynman is happy with that, okay? He said Landau started with the wrong theory. He was treating particles as indistinguishable. Then he made a mistake because he said there were gaps, but he got to the right thing. He made two wrongs. And this would be probably the right way. Okay, well, I want to go on instead. I want to consider another option, but still, there is something. There is a Hamiltonian. Could it mean anything, okay? So Can we postpone? I ask myself, can we postpone the interpretation? So, because if this is the case, then it means that there's no quantum fluid. That just means this thing doesn't exist quantum mechanically. So I don't want to give up, and I want to continue. And in a sense, what I can do is to drop the RR structure, drop Peter Weil, and just say, I only look at this representation. Okay. In other words, I have this Hamiltonian, okay? I have this Hamiltonian here. I have this algebra, okay? Let me build a representation of this algebra and see how the system behaves. You see, what I don't have, if I just proceed this way, is knowledge of which representations can I admit and which not. I don't have a rule that tells me this is your Hilbert space. Because before with a group,
you also have a world of them, no?
How many times do I take each of them? Yeah, maybe some of them are not there. But you see, in the evolution, each of them evolves independently.
You're right. So you take every euro at once. I think.
12 plus 1.
Yeah, sure.
But I could have some, I could not have. Okay.
So you think the point that, you know, it's not a locally compact group, so there's no notion of R measure on these groups.
Okay.
And there's a broken left measure, so I think it's natural to it. But you're using when you have the L, because there's an R measure, which is left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't exist on these.
Exactly, but what I want. So then, but let me tell you. But very good. But. Let me say, what if, in reality, this volume-preserving diff, because after all, I cannot, no fluid is forever. At sufficiently short distances, there are some reparametrizations that are at distances that are so short that this fluid has another description. So if there is an ultraviolet regulator, there may be a situation where actually the real group is manageable and finite.
Yeah, no,
so I don't know whether they are measured, but let's discuss later. Yeah. But you're raising a point for which I don't think I have an immediate answer.
Okay. But maybe, okay. Because the lambda quantization is essentially that, it's producing new representations that are the new type, right? Where in some sense it's discovering the atoms in quantization of the fluid.
Good question. Good. Maybe this resonates with what I will say at the end, if I get to. No, it's interesting. I cannot.
Okay.
So let me. So I said this. Now, how can I? So if I buy the second thing, how can I proceed? Okay. Now, if I just go this, then I only have the, I would say the technical, but maybe it's not just technical, the technical difficulty of dealing with this infinite group. However, there is a remarkable fact, which is one of the, which I learned in the CERN corridor from my friend George Savidi, is one of the few things that still work very well at CERN. You meet people, no, there are many other things, but this works very well. You meet people in the corridor and you learn things. That, as is known from people doing quantum gravity, membranes, condensed matter, in all sorts of ways, the error preserving diff on the torus can be viewed as the n going to infinity limit of SUN. Okay? And then, if this is also nice, okay, because the idea of making the constituent symmetry of the system finite dovetails very well with the fact that you expect that you should introduce a cutoff at a certain point. There was this problem of UV being there because there's no gap, and the UV matters, and this is interesting because now you have a way to introduce a cutoff, and you have a way to introduce a cutoff that is gentle. It preserves some symmetry, and this symmetry is huge, and when you send n to infinity, the system becomes huger, okay? So how do I go about that? So and that is the case, then my fluid is just a special case of a rigid body, rather than with the group SO3, it's with the group SUN. Okay? So now how do you construct this? How much time do I have?
I mean, I think 5 minutes if you can try to wrap up, but then you can.
Okay,
later. The room is
because you guys have a seminar now, right? Yeah. Okay, let me tell you very quickly. So there is a construction of this relation, which is very concrete, that is obtained by Toft, okay? And it works very well if you, for instance, consider n odd, okay? And essentially the n entries of the fundamental of SUN, you label them from this to that. It's just n discrete integers, okay? N integers. And the adjoint is just the product of fundamental anti-fundamental has n squared minus 1. So here when you do the product is n squared. And turns out that you can label the generators of SUN by matrices that are labeled by n squared minus 1 integers. Okay, take this n1 and n2, go in this range, okay, and take a product, okay. It forms, you can view that as a vector, as you can view it as a discrete two vector, and you already see that the torus comes out, right? Because momentum of the torus are two integers, okay? Of course, in a torus, in the continuous torus, the two integers go up to infinity, but if the torus is somewhat latticized, they go up to a maximum, okay? So what essentially you're doing here, you're turning your torus into a discrete, a latticized torus. Okay, you're doing that. So, and this is the algebra of SUN in this basis. This basis is built by using this. I think Toft is the one who constructed this. You can construct concretely these matrices this way. And if you rescale them properly, you find that the SUN algebra can be written in the following form. And now, if you consider generators. So the generators, this n, these are a discrete momentum going from essentially minus n over 2 to plus n over 2. If these n's and m here are sufficiently small, smaller than square root of n, then you can expand the sign and you get back the algebra of the volume preserving diffs. Okay? Now, in the algebra of preserving diffs, the coefficient here would grow. There would be a certain UV divergence, while here is regulated by a sign. Okay? So in other words, the SUN rigid body is the UV completion of a perfect fluid. Now, as I said, the space now is latticized. And going from n, now you can, everything was written in terms of momenta, but I can do discrete Fourier transform and turn my generators, which are labeled by momentum label, to space generator on a lattice. Okay, this is a discrete Fourier transform. These are just roots of the identity. It's just discrete Fourier transforms. Okay. And now, however, notice that your lattice is n by n. Okay, is n by n. Okay, but only momenta that are less than square root of n, as I said before, give you an algebra that is the one that you want for the fluid. Okay, for bigger momenta, for shorter distances, the algebra is different. So the momentum should be less than n, which means that the separation distance is complementary, should be bigger than square root of n. So even if your space is made by n times n, n square points, what you can do is to divide your torus, your latticized torus, into a coarse grain lattice, which consists, each cell is actually made of square root of n points, and there are square root of n of them. So each cell, as inside square root of n points, okay? And there are square root of n of them. Now, the length over which your system starts behaving like a fluid is this one here, okay? So in a sense, you have constructed a system that has n square variables, but the only variables that matter are n of them. So it's a bit of a monstrous regulation. You have much more than what you retain at the end, okay? It's like truly, I don't know whether it's like gold mining. I don't know. I don't know whether this is gold mining or so the fluid regime works on this coarse grain lattice. So now you can think of a Hamiltonian. Okay, the Hamiltonian was, as I said before, is RR over Laplacian. Okay, now, but R, now this cannot, you cannot sum to infinity. Okay, you cannot sum even to n because beyond a certain n, these objects are not. They do not have a fluid interpretation. So you introduce a cutoff, and the natural cutoff you introduce is the square root of n, is this length of the coarse grain lattice. Okay. And the question is that you hope that your result does not depend very much in which you do this, and it doesn't. Okay?
But don't you break this in the train now?
Eh?
Don't you break this in the train? As you have to break.
No, because the symmetry is broken by the this is like the right symmetry. Okay. This is like the symmetry. This is just the only thing I know is that the algebra of the variables. Okay. So the spectrum, the trivial wrap, well, energy zero, the fundamental. The fundamental, remember, it's n states, but I can write this thing as a n by n lattice, n square, but actually I can write it, as I said, as a coarse lattice, which is square root of n, and in this case, the number of points is n, so I have a number of lattice points, which is precisely the number of states of the fundamental. What is the guess for what the fundamental is? Well, the fundamental is nothing but a vortex localized on one of these points. Okay? And you can check that, and you can compute the energy of the fundamental, and you find that it diverges logarithmically, and which is precisely the energy of the vortex. In fact, if on the fundamental you compute the expectation value of vorticity, you find it has this form. Now, total vorticity integrates to zero because we are in a compact space, but if you compute that, you see that there is a delta function at the point where you are, and there is a mirror negative smear. But if you take the volume to infinity, this goes away. Now the question is, what is the antifundamental? The antifundamental is the antisymmetric product of n minus one fundamentals. So you have n points, and you have n minus one, and you have to antisymmetrize. They're all at different points, which means that you put a vortex everywhere apart from one point. If you put a vortex everywhere, you have nothing. If you don't put the vortex here, you have the contrary thing. You have an anti-vortex there. Okay, so this is the anti-fundamental. It's an anti-vortex. And this is just the picture of what you have. And then you can consider all the other wraps. Okay, these, they're all gapped. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say, they're gapped. This is precisely Landau's result. This is Landau's result, only there is also a log. But this is Landau's result. Okay. Well, the question is whether all the representations are like that. Okay, so as I said, the lowest wraps are all like that. But what about the adjoint? The adjoint is what? Is a tensor product of a fundamental and anti-fundamental. Now, in the tensor product of fundamental and anti-fundamental, there is the possibility of taking the vortex of the fundamental and the anti-vortex at the same point, and then constructing an entangled state where I sum over vortex and anti-vortex over all points. What state is this? It's a singlet, okay? And what energy does this state have? Zero, okay, because it's a singlet. But now imagine that I construct a state that is not a singlet, but where I put the two guys on top at every point, but locally, only locally, they are summing the same way. There is a smooth modulation. So locally it looks like a singlet, but globally it doesn't. Okay, so then by making it look at the singlet as much as possible, I would expect by locality the corresponding energy to go to zero. Okay, right? Is this? And in fact, this is what you have. Okay, essentially, when you consider the adjoint, you have essentially a number of states that is roughly n out of n squared that have a very low energy. In fact, more and the others instead are very gapped. So essentially, what you have is this. As I said, the joint, the states in the joint are labeled by the momentum, because remember these n1 and 2 integers are the labels of the joint, so I can label the states in the joint with their momentum. For vortices is not possible for the usual story that of particles in the magnetic field. Okay, it's the same thing, but for the joint you can. So what you have is that for the joint, when the momentum is lower than this cutoff. Okay, the cutoff corresponds to the coarse lattice. Then you have an ordinary quadratic non-relativistic dispersion relation. Okay, where essentially this is like a particle with mass of the order of the mass in over a region of the order of the cutoff. It's simply rho over lambda squared. 1 over lambda is the cutoff length, okay? So this is like a piece of fluid of the order of the cutoff that is moving with momentum p. On the other hand, when the momentum is large, you can see that, that the energy grows logarithmically, okay? And there is an intermediate stage is where the velocity becomes biggest, okay? But anyway, now this thing here really looks like two separated vortex and the vortex moving, okay? And, but you see, but this one corresponds to states in the adjoint that have a momentum bigger than the momentum which you declare to be the cutoff of your EFT. So this should be not in the EFT. But these are not in the EFT. These are vortex and the vortex that you can see, they're separated. That means that also the fundamental should not be admitted as a sensible representation. The only thing that is admitted is the tail of the adjoint. This is the only thing that truly matches the regime where SUN starts looking like the volume preserver.
So why? I mean, you can admit everything, but this
no, you can admit it, but yeah, but in this the states with this momentum are do not satisfy the algebra of volume preserving the corresponding states in the adjoint. Because they, you can associate the adjoint to the generators, right?
Well, you're talking about R's or L's? Because the R's, they should...
R's? Yeah. The R's, the R's.
R's.
There's no L here.
Yeah, but that...
Yeah, let's discuss later. I mean, I think I'm over time. Very quickly, what are the states? The states are tiny vorticity dipoles. They can be viewed, as I said, they correspond to a vortex and a vortex on top of each other. Normally, in superfluid, these states do not exist because when two vortexes get nearby, then they annihilate and they go somewhere else, okay? So this is a situation, somehow this system is a system where you could have bound state where vortices and antivortices can sit almost on top of each other. And their separation is just linear in their momentum, okay? So it's a state that has a dipole of vorticity that is proportional to the momentum. Okay? It's understandable. The more separated they are, the more, see, a vortex antivortex, one moves in the field of the other. If there is an antivortex here, makes this guy move, but this guy makes the other move, and they go. The more separated they are, the bigger they move. Now, this is the kinematics of individual representation. But now you can have, and this representation truly can be given the interpretation of quanta. What about, once you have quanta, I can imagine having a quantum here and a quantum there, and then having them move and see what happens. And this happens when you start considering bigger representations, representations that are tensor products of adjoints. If you consider tensor product two adjoints, then you will have symmetric and anti-symmetric Hilbert space, okay? And essentially you can interpret this as a bosonic Hilbert space, and this is a fermionic Hilbert space. It turns out that, and make a long story short, that in this two-sector, after you do all the computation, what the description of the system reduces to is to two different effective Lagrangian for two quanta here and two quanta there, in which case, in first case, they're bosons, in the other case, they're fermions, and the effective Lagrangian is essentially this. Okay, so this is the system that boils down from the construction. Now, the stuff that I'm doing now, after the paper I published a year and a half ago, consists in an alternative derivation of this result. Because there's an alternative Lagrangian description of fluids, which you can find, which is in terms of Clebsch variables. And we thought we had discovered these variables, we were very cool about them. Then I talked to a colleague, a mathematician, who told me that they were discovered by Clebsch in 1865. So we are always a bit behind, okay? Also with time, I'm sorry, guys. But we are doing it quantum mechanically, okay? So then you can compute things, okay? And here are the results, okay? So first you can compute the scattering in the boson in the fermion sector. And all this construction gives you a neat result, okay? You see, the scattering amplitude is just a function of the density, okay? So at the end, the initial idea that the Goldstone theorem, once you know the equation of state, you have the scattering amplitude, here it's realized in this way, okay? And these are very peculiar scattering amplitudes. For instance, the one for bosons, remember this momenta here, remember this is a non-relativistic system with a reference frame, okay? So you cannot go to a rest. There's no center of mass frame, okay? These guys are moving in a fluid. So it's convenient to write them in these terms, okay? With the initial state moment are P plus Q, P minus Q. And what you find here, for instance, in the bosonic channel is that you have the amplitude given by this. And this tells you that if you take P equal to Q, amounts to having the two incoming momenta to be equal, okay, just equal orthogonal, sorry. And when they are orthogonal, it means that in the bosonic channel, two of these guys coming from an avenue and a street, okay, I'm sabbatical in New York, they can go straight, okay, they don't interact, okay. Then there is other peculiarity in the fermionic channel, okay. If you have initial state that have the same energy, okay, then they cannot scatter into parallel final states. Okay, so there are. I mean, it's a very.
So this bosonic channel is actually yes. So there are two different sectors.
Well, exactly. No, but you see, the question is, we're going back to the same thing. Which representations are allowed in the held space? So, I admit this is something I am not.
You kept the 1, 0, and out.
Eh?
You kept the 1, 0, and out.
Yes. Yes. In fact, you should say that. What we should be represented is actually an opposite. Yeah. This is the thing we should know. Yes, you're completely right. Yes. We should only take those, and even those we should truncate to the lowest end of the
actually, why? I mean, what's physical? I mean, or mathematical reason?
The mathematical reason is that because everything is based on an algebra, and the algebra of volume preserving diffs coincides with the algebra of SUN only in for part of the adjoint, not for all the adjoint. Remember, the adjoint has this sign.
Yeah, but you say over ZN. So why over ZN?
Because all the guys that are like that are gapped, and I expect that they look like some free vortices like that. Okay, but this we didn't prove. This we didn't prove. Well, we sort of proved. But not in a rigorous way. So this is my summary. Sorry, guys, if I kept you longer. So my question is, I mean, is this a new universality class of finite density systems, or is just, something that cannot be constructed in any way? So you see, you would expect that anything that you can think as an effective description with some constructed with the chrismas of quantum field theory, there's going to be some lab who can engineer it one way or another. Okay, and the question is that whether this is the case or not. Okay, now I should say that there is something that looks very much like this. If you take 2+1 QED and with the magnetic field, which fixes a reference frame, which is the rest frame of the fluid, and then you interpret the electric field like the dual of the velocity, then the Gauss theorem tells you that the divergence of E is nothing but the vorticity. Therefore, the vorticity is double as the charge density. Now you understand why the Hamiltonian had the form of an electrostatic potential, electrostatic energy. And in this situation, the vortons, if you consider a situation where the Landau length and the Bohr radius of the positron are comparable, and they correspond to a Mikhatov, okay, and then you consider positronium. Okay, the positronium at rest is unpolarized, but when it moves in the rest frame of the moving positronium, the magnetic field has a tiny electrical field that makes it polarized, which creates a dipole of vorticity of charge. Okay, which in this case is vorticity. So if you compute the interaction, the scattering amplitude is precisely the one I had. Okay, so this, of course, with the difference that now this positronium has a 0 point energy, which is the mass of the two of E plus E minus. Okay, so the energy, so the dispersion relation is k squared, but there is a constant involved, the constant plus k squared. But this is not what worries me most. What worries me most is that the scattering amplitude that you get this way, because these are like dipoles. Okay, is that it's the interaction of two dipoles. Okay, dipoles that grow with, but the dipole is proportional to the orthogonal to the momentum, okay? So you get precisely that scattering amplitude depending, if you make this bound state to be bosons, you get the bosons. If it's a boson and a fermion, you have the fermionic one. The only thing is that these are atoms. And my scattering amplitude was derivative. So it was purely derivatively coupled. Well, in this case, there's also a hard scattering. If I take two atoms and they scatter hard, there's an S wave scattering which is independent of of momentum. Okay. No. No. Like an atom, if I take the interaction, if I write in an effective Lagrangian interaction of two atoms, it's like a quartic interaction with no derivative. And so I think this, and I yeah, exactly, I don't know how to get rid of that. Okay. Now, this is the obsession. Then we come to the professionalism. Now the question is, okay, this, maybe I took this thing so seriously, I wanted to say, look, there is a Lagrangian. Normally when I have a Lagrangian, normally, okay, I can view it either classical or quantum mechanical. Okay, there are anomalies, there are other things, but in a simple EFT like this, that's normally the case. I mean, that's my experience. There is the hydrogen atom, you can view it classically, you can view quantum mechanically. Classically, there's no ground state, quantum mechanically there is, it looks very different. So what is the story here? Okay, I went and got down to this. But it's not clear whether this thing can be realized. But then remains the question, the Lagrangian of the fluid, of a relativistic fluid, to what extent that Lagrangian is good for systematically describing real fluid, like the fluid that you have in hot QCD, when you're not dominated by quantum effects like here, where you have statistical dissipation, what is the systematic description? This, I think, is still not done, and this is what I would like to do. I don't know whether this will help, but suffering with this, maybe. Anyway, sorry, this is all I had to say.
This one, is this like fractons?
No. What? No, fractons, it is related. I mean, in fact, my former student, collaborator, and friend, Gabriel Cuomo, we were discussing. I honestly, I haven't studied fractals in detail, but at least at the classical level, the amount of degeneracy here is more dramatic because omega is equal to zero. It's not at zero in some direction. But they are weird. They are the same class of weird effectively. But this is why I'm interested. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. So they. The reason why I'm interested is because it's a weird incarnation of quantum field theory. Yeah, but fractons can be realized in systems.
Yes, yeah. They're
also simple lattice.
Actually, they're also due to elasticity theory. So to the elasticity should be somewhat.
Sorry, elasticity theory. The elasticity I understand myself. There are phonons in this and that direction, and they go at certain. So it's elasticity theory where in some direction it's very soft.
This discrimination to logical effects of behaving sort of way that only the dipole is conserved.
I don't know. Maybe I should look into that. Yeah, I will certainly look into that. I haven't had yet time. Now I think understanding real fluids. There's a lot of work on real fluids, and that's a bit embarrassing on my side that I've never really studied because I was taken by this obsession. There are all these papers by Hong Liu on one side, and Rangamani and others on the other, where they, starting with holography, they developed this effective field theory for dissipative fluids. But it is not clear to me how is this description systematic as any other effective field theory, where, just to say it in extreme, even if you are an idiot, you can do computation, just crank the machine, right? Systematic expansion. And then, you see, in that case, the waves, just my intuition is that they are not quanta like in this case. The waves in an ordinary relativistic fluid are classical waves. But then the question is, how do you systematically compute the quantum effects? So that's. By the way, yeah, in these constructions, the construction is on Hong Liu and also Son. They start with this volume-preserving diffs, But the question is, where do these volume perceptive come from in the original theory? The original theory, you don't have them. QCD, where is volume perceptive? Is it an accidental symmetry? Is it a gauge symmetry? Well, it's a gauge symmetry, then you end up like in the case of Landau. Okay. Yeah, maybe the guys doing quantum gravity know how to deal with these things because yeah, they have this other language. I don't know. Thanks for listening, guys.
This
would be more like a whole fluid. Yeah. This is like a whole. This would be more looking like a. But in the whole fluid, you have occupancy. No, but the doors are all occupied, right? Here, I don't have occupation. Here, it's the vacuum. So remember, in the whole fluid, you have the first Landau level is all filled. Right? Here, I'm not doing that.
Normal.
Yeah.
Right?
It's partly filled. Yeah, how to connect to that is, again, something that I haven't yet understood how to do. Yeah.
Okay, so thanks for speaking.